I investigate media, and I don't pretend to understand them in any complete sense at all. But I find them very exciting things to investigate. They are, as you know, parts of our own bodies, enlarged and extended into the to create human environments. The any technology is a part of ourselves acting as a new environment. Media really create environments rather than content. However, we'll go into that a bit later. One of the things that happened last night after we gave a talk on these kinds of things at the Museum of Modern Art last night, and Tony was there and did his concert that you've just had, but I learned several things last night, just more or less.
We got hearing problems. I wonder if this one would work any better. Can you?
Well, I can speak louder.
All right.
Okay. One of the things I learned last night, quite unexpectedly,
a little closer,
was that the TV. Someone had been asking a question I often am asked. I was explaining the difference between movies and TV, or some of the differences. And they said, well, what about when a movie is shown on TV? Is that TV or is that movie? Well, it was as a result of meditating a little bit on that one that the matter suddenly came up that the TV image is framed. And the picture frame that it currently and quite incidentally and accidentally is used around the TV image, the picture frame, does strange things to the TV image that it does things that are not done to the movie image at all. And we are, with new technology of the laser ray type, going to have, instead of panels on which the TV image will appear, instead of panels, we're going to have them in multi-dimensions right in the middle of the room. You can walk around them. But the effect of picture frame stuck around the TV image is at present one of the most grotesque, irrelevant features of the TV scene. I never thought of it before. It's so completely environmental as to be invisible. One of the peculiarities of environments is they're invisible. That's the delightful point about Father Galkin's story of the fish. The one thing a fish would be naturally completely unaware of is water. The things we're always totally unaware of are the things that are most pervasive, and in the case of our own immediate experience, we are engaged in forming an image of ourselves, a body percept. Every instant of our existence, we form a body percept of ourselves of which we are totally unaware because it is completely environmental. The image we form every instant of consciousness of our bodies as an environment, this activity is something of which we're completely unaware because it is so total and pervasive. One of the things that's happening in our new world is that we use so many media simultaneously. We have so many kinds of experiences of the at the same time, what is called the world of the happening, that we are becoming sophisticatedly conscious of the differences among media, the differences among our own sensations and our own physical powers. Well, before I want to make an allusion to Tony. I'm very grateful to him for a story he told me about New York 19. He said there was a policeman down here who said to me one day, if you're ever in trouble, Tony, don't shout help, shout fire. Now, I realized at once that this was a godsend in matter of explaining the hot and the cool. Many people have difficulty understanding the difference between hot media and cool media. Movie is a hot medium, TV is a cool medium, but why? Well, if you yell help, that's real cool because it's involving. People don't want to get involved. Yell fire, that's real hot and impersonal and uninvolving. People don't mind answering fire. But they don't want to get involved in other people's problems or other people's lives. That's cool. Fire is hot, but it means impersonal, detached, uninvolved. The hot medium leaves you relatively detached outside. The cool medium takes you in, involves you. However, that's just only one very small matter to which I am indebted to Tony Schwartz. I've been doing quite a bit of work lately on James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake, because you may know there are 10 thunderclaps in that work. And each one is a means of expounding the characteristic of a major technological event in the human past. The 10th thunderclap on page 424 is TV. And it is post-history, as it were. The seventh thunderclap is radio. The eighth one is movie. And the episode that concerns movie and TV is called The Oint and the Grasshopper, the motor car and the airplane. Joyce doesn't just deal with the media in isolation, but he deals with them as they affect each other. Now, you probably never thought of the movie as a form of motor car, but the motor car is a kind of a movie unit. You are a camera. You are a projector. You have a complete moving picture world at your disposal in a motor car. TV, the movie as a mode of extension, extends your eyes and your feet, just like the motor car. Our feet act as a mobile platform for our eyes. The movie camera is eyes and feet wedded together. The TV camera is not. The TV camera, as Joyce points out, is more like the airplane. Whereas the motor car extends your feet and eyes, the airplane extends your whole body, all your senses at once. That's TV. The TV, he calls over and over again, the charge of the light brigade. It's a world of electronic particles charging down a tube at you. You are the screen. The TV viewer is not a camera. He is a screen. The effect of being a screen is profoundly different from being a camera. The person who is acting as a screen becomes completely involved in the environment. In the movie world, you sit back and you look at an image. You look at the environment. In TV, you are the environment in action. Psychologically or psychosomatically, the effect of TV on our young people is fantastically different from the effect of movies. Movies taught detachment. They're very closely related to the book form. They taught individual detached modes of objective viewing and private fantasy. The TV viewer is not detached, and he does not engage in fantasy. He is deeply involved in the actual situation. The TV camera does not have a shutter, does not take pictures. It picks up the actual world and handles it. The scanning finger, you can carry it all the way to Nebuchadnezzar if you like. The moving finger writes, and having written, moves on. But the TV image, it may be the handwriting on the wall, but it is a completely handling, tactile form of handling of world. It picks up the world. It doesn't look at the world at all. It picks it up and handles it, involves the viewer in it, in depth. Psychologically, the effects of TV are completely antithetic to the effects of movie. A On the other hand, you see, the most of the content of TV appears to be movies. That is, typically, the content of any new medium is always the old medium. This was true even in Plato's day. The content of Plato's writing was the old oral tradition. He was completely unconscious of this. He was as unaware of the medium of writing as we are of the medium of TV. The reason being quite simply that any new medium creates a new environment which is completely invisible. What you see in the new environment is the old environment. What you see on TV are old movies. What people saw in the printed book in the first two or three centuries of printing were the old medieval manuscripts. Every new form typically repeats the old experience and creates a strange deceit or illusion. Well, just to finish off the Joyce illusion before plunging into this matter a little further. Joyce is the only person, I think, who ever did a complete study of human ecology, that is, the ecology of human man-made environments. Finnegan's Wake is really an ecological scientific study of man-made environments, not natural environments, in which the environments themselves, man-made environments, are dealt with as profoundly reshaping the total situation. Since I mentioned the fact that the content of TV is the old medium movie, the content of the old movie, of course, was the old printed forms, storybooks and newspapers and magazines, photographs. Somebody might ask, well, what's going to happen to TV? When will it become content? And the answer is not far away, satellites. Satellite broadcasting will make TV the content. The satellite is already a new environment going around TV and will gradually or maybe suddenly transform TV into an art form. One of the peculiar and rather amusing aspects of technological change is that every time a new medium is formed, the old one not only becomes content, it becomes an art form. Film is now respected, art form. It used to be just junk. Very shortly, up until TV, the movie was just trash. But it became an art form with TV. And TV will become an art form with satellite broadcasting. But not only will TV become an art form, the planet is going to become an art form, because as we put a new environment around man's natural habitat, the planet, inevitably, the new environment processes the old one, the natural habitat, into an art form. We're going to give the planet the old Williamsburg treatment. This is already beginning, but we're going to lovingly and with the utmost regard to archaeology and history, we're going to reconstruct every phase of this planet as it was originally. It's going to be. It's going to take a lot of money from the foundations, I'm afraid, in the next while. But the whole planet is going to be restored to a sort of Garden of Eden status. The climate will be readjusted to what it probably was at this or that time, and all kinds of artistic developments are to be programmed. It also points to the fact that one of the strange results of electronic developments is that the environment, the human environment itself, can be dealt with as an art form. We used to think of art as something that you put in a special environment, a special place. But what is now happening is that the environment itself is becoming an art form, and we begin to realize that the environment itself is a teaching machine, a brainwasher. All education is brainwashing. If it occurs slowly enough, we think of it as respectable. If it's speeded up, we call it brainwashing. But today, when it becomes possible to program the total human environment, we suddenly realize, why teach literacy when you can program the environment to create all the psychic effects of literacy without even having any reading or writing? This is perfectly feasible. You can program the environment to create the effects of all sorts of curricula without ever having mentioned them. But the environment as a teaching machine is an infallible device. People always respond to the environment, even when they don't respond to teaching. There's a strange example of this in a book by Edgar Anderson called Plants, Man, and Life, something like that, in which he points out that the botanical world is quite powerless to classify or even identify the plants and the flowers in anybody's backyard. He goes on to insist that the garden or the backyard is a machine that accelerates all natural processes fantastically. It creates new hybrids and new kinds of plants and flowers at a rate which far beyond the competence of science to classify. The only place where the science of botany can reign is in the Himalayas or in the Andes or in nice remote places where nature is not speeded up by gardens. Gardens, man-made environments, are machines. Now, let's think about that in relation to the man-made environments we call educational establishments. Environments speed up natural processes to such a point that they create endless hybrids and freaks in the plant world to a point where science is quite helpless. Think of that one in relation to the products of our educational environments. The study of environments rather than the content of environments is just about due to begin. The study of environments as teaching machines. For example, the motor car as a technology is rather insignificant, but when you look at the environment the motor car created, look at the network of roads and services, the oil companies and all the attendant services that go with that little gimmick. You can see the motor car is nothing, but the environment created by the motor car is vast. Same for radio. The same for writing. The thing itself is almost nothing. The environment it creates in psychic and somatic terms, fantastic, vast. All man-made environments are means of accelerating processes. Electronic environments accelerate all processes, especially those of apprehension and learning, to a point where they have practically become an extension of human consciousness. The program, the man-made environment, is in effect an extension of human consciousness. As long as we think of consciousness as a little pellet or something inside the brain, we're not likely to find out very much about learning or education. However, one of Tony's illustrations about Bosco reminded me of Sacro Bosco, which is the Latin term for Hollywood. Sacro Bosco is an old medieval term, you know, for the holy grove, the sacred ritual place, Sacro Bosco. Sacro Bosco themes us in very nicely for our occasion here. But the another thing that Tony brought up last night that ties in with the movies, and he didn't bring it up today. He asked last night the question, is there such a thing as black and white sound? The answer is yes. Black and white, chiaroscuro, light and shade, it means a gradation. In Dr. Zhivago, there is very little black and white sound. There is just the sudden crash of iconic encounters. When you graduate the sound and make the transitions of between sounds natural or simple, quiet, that's black and white. In other words, everything we associate with classical music, with melody, this is black and white sound, in the sense that it is chiaroscuro. Now, the sort of noises you get in Batman are iconic noises, just as the Batman image is iconic. It's not photographic. It has no chiaroscuro. The reason that Batman revives with color TV, for example, is quite simply that color is a world of iconic contour and immediate encounter without any graduation of tones or sounds. Hence the pow, zowie, bam, and so on. These are iconic sounds. Dr. Zhivago, for some reason or other, is well supplied with them. I've often puzzled about why the Russians dropped out of the film business when sound came in. On paper, you'd say the sound should have been a great advantage to the Russians, because their movies were thought of as avant-garde, artistic things, Eisenstein, Potemkin, so on, because of precisely this quality of the icon that they got into their pictures. It gives a kind of primitive, immediate impact using this very low-grade photographic image. TV is a very low-grade image, too, as compared with ordinarily competent photography. But for reasons which I think you might find quite valuable to investigate, and for which no answers have been provided up till now, the Russians were knocked out of the film business by sound. It changed their relation to the image, the photographic image, so drastically that they couldn't cope. We made the transition to sound fairly quickly by changing our photographic image, by intensifying it in various ways. You cannot use the same photographs or the same photography when you have a soundtrack. In a sense, sound pictures were the new radio environment going around the old photographic environment. It's a very complicated story. One of the consequences of radio going around photography, in the case of sound pictures, one of the consequences was a tendency, you can read this on page 158 of Night, The Liveliest Art, it's a book, a very good book about film. But one of the consequences was the tendency to bear down in depth on the photographic image, and instead of using it for narrative or sequence, to use it as a variation of a mood, to try to get a whole variety of effects out of an image rather than just to tie it together in a sequence to tell a story. You can see this happening in the Fellinis, the Bergmans, and others. The storyline is disappearing. Well, having made my transition from Tony's splendid performance, I'm going to have a quick peek at what I intended to say to you people. I had intended, of course, to be very lighthearted and tell you about the two goats who were chomping away on an MGM studio dump. One of them kicked open a can containing a picture of Gone with the Wind and was nibbling away at this and got very excited, signaled to his pal, come on, get a bit of this. When the other goat came along and nibbled away at it a bit, he said, how do you like it? He said, well, honest, I like the book better. This is characteristic of the profundity of most media comment.
How about a message to the goats?
a message from the goats, as Father said.
Let me give you a rest there.
All right.
I want to rest his left arm and also maybe get him back on the radar screen. Any one sentence there, you could kind of go out and spend a few minutes working on. Can I just put into some kind of, form for us fish, some of the things that helped me find out what you're saying and then apply it to kids? Because I think we want to get back these kids who have got this new relationship. As I understand McLuhan, this is, big, brash child here, and these are the principles that I can use as a roadmap through the type of things that Marshall just said. If we take our senses in some crude analogy, think of them as having 100 ergs of energy. We have a limited amount of sense energy to use visually, orally, tactilely, smelling around, and things like that. The fact of the matter is that at different times in our lives and in different cultures, the workload of different senses changes very radically. If we blind a man, the workload of his 100 ergs of sense energy, which he still has available, are redistributed through his other senses, so that there's a heightening of the tactile sense and there's a heightening of his sense of hearing. Now, the McLuhan thesis is that every language and every culture, and more importantly, because this is his uniqueness here, all the media toward which we're exposed in any great degree in our life alter the sense ratios, the sense patterns, so that we will have in different cultures and at different times within the same culture because of the media, a repression almost of some senses, and then a rediscovering or heightening of some senses. Now, there's a lot of footnoting we could do here. When we went to school, the lowest form of humor was the pun. Puns are not a very low form of humor at all. Children have great delight with them, and interestingly, they're very popular these days. But in a culture which had repressed its ears in order to emphasize its eyes, especially toward the printed page, puns were not fun at all, because they don't make very much sense on a page. They make a lot of fun for the ear. Now, if we look at the kids' dances today, the Frug and the Watusi and all these things, the one thing we notice about them is that they are large, all-involving, total-body kind of things, which is a recovery, McLuhan is saying, because of the fact that TV has got this handling, this tactile quality. Kids brought up on television are going to recover a tactile sense or a kinetic sense or that kind of Zorba the Greek feel for life, which the culture itself has repressed to the great, enormous psychological unhealthiness of the people involved. The mothers of our tightly wound world who bring their kids up and say, sit still, don't look around, shut up, are just, really getting those kids really ready for the psychologist at the other end of the trail, because they're taking all of the senses and repressing them. And Western literate man has had most of his sense and emotional life repressed in return for the ability to read, because we've overemphasized. Now, the big thing these days is the total media thing and the new approach to the arts, not just as fancy things to hang on the wall, but the arts as extensions of man, as ways of recovering the sensitivity of our tactile, kinetic, and oral sense. These are all what's involved here. And what I hear McLuhan saying is that coming out of an era in which print had a monopoly on human communication, especially within the schools, because the schools and are the great teachers here, they tribalize the young. The total environment now, the school is only one, it's a junior varsity teacher. It's the least important educator in many ways today. The total environment of the city, of the mass media and things like that, these are really the great teachers. And the enormous tension, we could analyze that film yesterday, nobody waved goodbye, as a tension between these two cultures and things like that. That the kids are now coming into the school with a highly developed sense of involvement, of wanting to participate in what they're doing, and wanting to use all their senses, and are being repelled by old-fashioned school systems, which still tells them that they're only receivers, and that the only medium that makes any difference is print. Now, this is very different just from our little conspiracy to teach movies in the school is so unimportant in a sense compared to this enormous thing, which has to do with our whole life. Our whole way of perceiving the world is at stake here. That's really all I want to say. That we take the media themselves are extensions of our senses. The stone axe was an extension of our hand. Something outside of ourselves enabled us to do hand-like things. Telescopes extend our eyes. Glenn says cars extend our feet and our eyes. Television extends our eye and our hand. So art imitates nature, and we put all these things outside of us. But then nature imitates art. And the things that we put outside of us, the things that we shape, then shape us. And unless we understand, and the difficulty is always understanding the water when you're in the pond, we're the least likely people to discover what our own environment is about because we're inside it. And we can now start to discover, because McLuhan lives in outer space, and he can tell us what we look like from out there, and we can also make comparisons across cultures, and we can make comparisons between media or something like that.
For this relief, much thanks. One thing about outer space, as Bucky Fuller points out, in order to go into orbit, you have to take the planet with you. In order to take the planet with you in the capsule, in the complete simulation of the planetary environment or habitat, in order to do that, you have to understand the structure of this planet and its relation to the human body as never before. So, as Bucky says, the capsule is the first completely designed man environment. It's the first environment ever designed completely for man. The Earth is not designed for man, it just happened. There's a, to this audience, I can use the term habitus, and I think you may find it of some relevance to understanding media. You see, when you are subjected to a particular type of culture or a particular environment, you make a total psychosomatic response, which is habitus. Every medium creates an environment which creates a new habitus for the whole population affected by that environment. Habitus is completely unconscious. But habitus is very tightly related to our intellectual lives, as we know. But it, that doesn't mean that it's conscious. I merely give you the word habitus in relation to the psychosomatic changes and adjustments we make in new environments. And obviously, the astronaut has to develop a habitus that we wouldn't all expect to share. But another thing about, I have a friend, a novelist friend, an English chap, who said, you know, the only work that royalty has to perform is to grow up. They don't have to get ready for a job or any particular skill. Their job is just growing up. Now, you see, a king or a member of royal family has to really share the total life of his people. He has to know everything. This is the fate now of democratic man. He is becoming royal. He lives in an environment which involves him in everything at once, every type of knowledge simultaneously. That is now an environmental fact of his mode of existence. His relation to this new type of environment made of information is growing up. Paradoxically, then, democratic man is going to end in by becoming totally royal, and perhaps a deserved fate. But it's a nice paradox. Now, apropos Watusi and Froude, I'm very grateful to Father for reminding me of that one. If you remember, the old dance floor was a place in which you moved around as if it were a continuum, if there was a continuous space you could move in. The new dances do not require a continuous space. Each space is made by the dancer and is a completely closed space bubble. Space is no longer something that we get into. We make it. Also time. This happened, you know, in Alice in Wonderland. If you look at Lewis Carroll again, you'll find that he took us through the looking glass into this world we all live in now. When you go through the looking glass, you go out of visual space into a space-time world which is made by the occupant. Alice made that world. As soon as she went through the looking glass, she began to make her own space and her own time in Einsteinian terms. Lewis Carroll was at least as sophisticated as Einstein, and perhaps the only way really to present these matters is playfully. But the Watusi and the Frug are space-time Einsteinian forms of space bubbles made by the dancers. The dancers used to dance around in space, the old dance floor. Now they make space, and you couldn't ask anybody anymore for the next dance. There's no way of asking anybody for the next dance or of dancing with anybody. Each one is engaged in making a world. And we call this conformity, somewhat ineptly. Conformity is the rearview mirror, if ever there was one. It's the last thing we're getting. Now, another, apropos of this Watusi thing, just as there is no continuous dance floor space for the Watusi or the Prug, etc., so in our art forms there is no longer a storyline. As we move into the new electronic forms, out of the visual, merely visual world, we abandon storyline or continuity. And you can see this happening. In fact, one of the first observations made by librarians 15 years ago when TV was new was the children are not asking for storybooks, they're asking for fact books. And this was considered to be a terrible decline of the imaginative life. But at the time, TV is not a narrative medium. Movie is. One of the delightful things about the movie is that it is a parallel to life. That is, it's a parahodos, a parody. The movie, insofar as it can give you a complete image of the world you live in, is a parody, a parallel, a parahodos. And when the movie came in, Valerie, the poet, said, it represents a complete mechanical memory. You can recall every facet of situations you had merely seen once. Now, the movie, in other words, was pointing toward the computer as a retrieval system. The movie as a retrieval system has many points of for comparison and contrast with computers. But one of the new meanings of our world is this power of instant and perfect retrieval of information. When our young people have access to both movie and computer types of retrieval, they can, of course, always tie it in with telephone and other systems, then the whole learning process takes on new dimensions. When you have instant recall of complex data, you can use the retrieval system for as a means of discovery, pattern discovery. You can use it as a means of research. Typically, at present, we're still using this marvelous new form to store classified data. It's like the old horse, first motor cars with buggy whip holders. We're still looking at the computer as if it were a means of doing what we're already doing. But I'm not going to try to go deeply into that one. It's going to take us deeply into things anywhere. One of the ways of getting to see the movie as a system of information retrieval is simply to compare it for a moment with the newspaper. The newspaper as a form has many strange and bizarre features. All those little items have no storyline. They have a dateline. The newspaper has no storyline. There's no connection between anything and anything else in a newspaper. We have accepted this complete mosaic hodgepodge without any question, as if it were a perfectly rational, sensible procedure. Take the dateline off any newspaper at all, doesn't matter what newspaper, and you have a surrealist poem, an extreme form of Dada, surrealism. Poems, a newspaper is a situation in which everything happens at once, thanks to the telegraph. A newspaper has no storyline, but it's a happening in which everything happens at once. It's an environment. As an environment, the newspaper, as a form, presents a world, but no story. It presents experience and participation, but no point of view. It's typical of our inability to perceive environments that the newspaper has never been studied as an art form. The newspaper, of course, was created by the telegraph, the newspaper we know. prior to the telegraph, the newspaper was just an editorial sheet. But with the coming of the telegraph, the newspaper took on all the characteristic electronic forms of happening. And a happening is a thing in which everything happens at once. And I like to think of it as formal causality. Formal causality, as opposed to other kinds of causality, is a causality in which all causes operate simultaneously. But I'm throwing that out as a probe. The things, when I make statements like that, I don't intend them to be taken as absolute factual packages of information. I intend them as probes, to be used as probes to find out other things. They're not definitive. I'm not speaking from a point of view. I'm perfectly willing to drop it and take up another probe to get on with the business of exploring the environment.
Well, let's, how about kids now? Traditionally, of course, the school is the last place to find out what's happening and to do something about it. And therefore, if we got these happening kids, who are across the board media kids, who have got all kinds of new sensory profiles, and we're programming them through the old linear, one thing after another of the school, we're in trouble. What do you want to do with the kids we get in schools?
Well, I don't have any specific program. I'm just interested in talking about some of the things we could do. When the entire world becomes available, accessible as field of information and awareness, it seems obvious that exploration and discovery must play a much larger role and instruction must play a much smaller role in the future. Instruction is really just a form of stenciling on brain pan. Discovery, exploration, probing is much more proper to the inhabitants of an electronic environment because the amount of information available is beyond anybody's wish or need for instructional purposes. Nobody wants to know all that. What we desperately do need is to know the pattern that structures that, this or that. Let me say a few words about coming up to that point again from another point of view. Eric Havelock has a wonderful book called Preface to Plato, in which he describes the transition from the Homeric world of teaching. Homer was the teaching establishment in the 6th century B.C. He discusses the transition to the Platonic world, where ideas and classified data took over from Homeric gestalt. The reason that Plato, it becomes perfectly plain, the reason that Plato was opposed to the poets was they represented the educational establishment and had been for many centuries. It wasn't just an aesthetic matter at all. Now, with the rise of literacy, phonetic literacy, the possibility of a detribalized man, a detached, fragmented, separate person out of the tribe, a man instructed in classified data, visually ordered experience, what Plato did was to discover the techniques of applying visual classification to the world of the mind. These are called the ideas. As the visual level of their culture rose, they extended visual principles of ordering knowledge to all levels of life and created civilization. Tremendous achievement. I personally am very loath to make value judgments about these things because they concern so many people. How can one make a value judgment about procedures that concern just about everybody? Was it Edmund Burke who said, "I do not know the means of drawing up an indictment against an entire nation"? However, value judgments, insofar as they extend to entire populations, are very tricky things, and I avoid them. It's not because I don't use them privately in special situations, but The understanding of processes becomes a natural need when you're subjected to these vast new environments. Instead of a point of view on what is it or what's happening, what is needed is an empathic understanding of process. However, Eric Havelock reveals how this amazing literacy revolution transformed the whole mode of learning from the Homeric gestalt, which was very involved. Everybody memorized him, to the classified idea world of Plato. Now, that Western education followed that course with some little variations right on through past Gutenberg to the present. What we call information and knowledge is classified information and knowledge. It's in categories, it's in filing cabinets, it's under alphabetic listings. With Gutenberg and the stepping up of the visual life to high intensity, as compared with the old manuscript culture, the entire world suddenly was transformed into a rear-view mirror, and what we call the sense of modern history was born. The past became suddenly very visible in the rear-view mirror of print. And an obsession with the past became characteristic of that first age of printing. This explains a great deal of the literature of that time, including people like Hamlet. Look on this picture and on that. Look on that noble gentleman, my father of yesteryear, and look at this horrible thing now. Hamlet, like all the revengers out of the Revenger tragedy, was a man alienated from the present. The first age of print had the effect of alienating the whole population from the present and obsessing them with the human past. This reached its peak in Milton's Paradise Lost, where the whole of human society became a rearview mirror to look at the Garden of Eden. There's really a fantastic illusion that the function of human life is to be a rearview mirror for some distant past event. It reached a sort of parody of itself in the next century with the Graveyard School of Poetry, with everybody meditating on the graves, on the past, and the mute and glorious Miltons and Cromwell's guiltless of their country's blood, using the dead present as a rearview mirror. It ended suddenly with the coming of the landscape poetry of the Romantics, in which nature was used not as a mirror for the past, but as the mirror for the mind of man. It sort of liberated people from history. After centuries of this rearview mirror, the mind of man was suddenly mirrored in nature and was liberated from history, or the historical obsession. Now, the rearview mirror is sometimes called the learning theory that we have to go from the known to the unknown. In fact, this means that whenever you encounter the known, the unknown, you translate it into what you already know. In other words, you avoid it. The only person who dare encounter the unknown, the new, directly, the Gorgon, without a mirror, is the artist. Artists, in any age, are experts in direct encounter with the present, and they report their probings and findings in all sorts of grotesque designs. What the pop artists are telling us, you see, is that the environment itself has now become a work of art. That is a direct probe of a new electronic situation. The report is completely misunderstood. People are standing around classifying their endeavors as if it was the content of their endeavors that had to be judged. What they're desperately trying to tell us is something has happened. We live now in a new kind of world. We are now responsible for the environment. We're not responsible for the contents of the museum. This is quite a big flip over. It's like saying to the scientist, we don't want proof anymore. We want prediction. Proof is, after all, based on classification and repetition. It's rearview mirror. Prediction is what is needed at a very fast-moving jet paced period. We do not need proofs, we need predictions. Accurate predictions. That kind of revolution is taking place right under our noses. But the obsession with the rearview mirror is still built into our whole educational establishment. Now, one way out of it is simply to understand how we got into it. That's a sort of psychiatric procedure. Understand the process by which you got trapped, and you're out. Literally. This is Edgar Allan Poe's discovery in The Philosophy of Composition. The way to solve any problem, he said, is to start at the point where it has been solved and then go back to the point you'd have to begin in order to solve it. In other words, you reverse ordinary procedures. But the artist is the only person who is prepared to face the present and therefore to tell us about the future, because as our friend Father Calkins and my friend Jerry Fagan says, the future of the future is the present. This is always true. But very few people dare look at the present. I don't think it comes easy to people in any period. Never heard of anybody except artists who could do it. And the artist does it because he's prepared to use his senses as scientific instruments instead of just using them as pickup devices for his own satisfaction. He is engaged in a critique of satisfaction. He's willing to put aside or reject all satisfaction in order to discover and probe. One of the most exciting things that ever happened to my 15-year-old daughter in grade 11 was joining a team of children who were asked to devise a new educational system that would include the modern world and adapt it to the old educational curriculum. They were also asked to design an environment and architecture for such an enterprise. They were given months, and there were several teams in Toronto and several teams in Rochester, and they finally got together to share notes. One of the things that made this so exciting to them was the knowledge that nobody knew the answers. You see, if those kids had been given a job for which any answers existed at all, they could never have participated in it with any conviction. It's like a rigged quiz show. As long as people think the show's live, they're involved. The moment they hear it's rigged, they're out. But you give children today live problems for which adults do not know the answers, and they'll work like fury. They have vast resources in any town of this continent to use, and they, above all, delight in exchanging their discoveries and dialoguing. You've all heard of the Hawthorne experiment. There's a recent paperback on it called Hawthorne Revisited. At the Hawthorne Electric Plant near Chicago, experiments were carried out in which the workers were given a great many opportunities to prescribe what sort of environment would you like to work in. More leisure, less leisure, more heat, less heat, more light, less light, more sound, less sound, so on. They were allowed to program the environment on an experimental basis to find out what happened. To the amazement of the experimenters, no matter what they did to the environment, work performance went up, 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 whether the environment was improved or worsened. They came to the conclusion that people just liked a little attention, and they're wrong. What these people were absolutely thrilled by was the fact that they were engaged in a discovery process, and their work and their learning had become one thing. The discovery of a means of merging work and learning in one form releases untold energies in ordinary people. This is when those two forms are split apart, there's great frustration and defeat of energy. But when work and learning and discovery merge, then there's tremendous release of energy. We live in an electronic environment where this is quite easy to arrange, where people don't have to be pigeonholed and fitted into slots and categories and taught by stenciling and so on. However, I'm not suggesting that we should at once launch into this at all. I'm simply probing and inviting you to do likewise. I have a lot... here's a curious thing. I find that while I hold this microphone in my hand, I can't look at my notes. And I had a fixed microphone last night, no trouble looking at my notes. But, so I'm going to skip the rest of my notes and turn it right back to Father. Thanks very much.